Welcome to the Kill the Lion podcast. We're back, baby. We've been gone for a very long time. I've made a ton of movies between the last podcast and this one. I hope you've checked them out, and I hope you've missed this podcast because it is back. I'm doing them again. We got a great episode for you today. We have Kurt Jenkins. He's a musician, an actor, now a filmmaker. He's doing a lot of great stuff. He recently shot an entire feature film on the cruise ship that he was working on, basically just run and gun guerrilla style with his friends and coworkers there. I think that's amazing because like this is his first feature film, and he just took that as his undertaking. You know, he was like, I'm on this ship. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be on here, but like I can shoot a movie and I'm going to do so. So he's editing that now. He's in that stage. We're going to talk to him. We're going to find out more about that. And by the way, if you like this show and if you like the movies that I make, go to killthelionfilms.com. $1. That's all I'm asking. $1 per month. Just set it and forget it. $1 will be deducted from your payment, whatever of preference or whatever. And it'll go to me, and it's just a nice little donation. Keep me making movies, keep me making podcasts and everything that I do. So thank you to everyone who has done that already, and thank you in advance to anyone who chooses to do that. And now, Kurt Jenkins. Kurt, good to talk to you.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me.
Kurt, you've completed at least, I want to say, like you're halfway in your feat of making a movie on a cruise ship. You've shot it. I believe you're in the editing process now. Where are you at right now with it?
Right now, I've got an assembly cut, and I'm in the process of turning that assembly cut into creative expression. I'm out of the factory, and I'm into the studio.
Cool. And do you like what you've seen so far?
I do. My wife and I watched the cut last night. She wanted to see it. And, you know, aside from the obvious things that need to be done in terms of pacing and maybe some creative use of storytelling, of joining scenes together in a way, the bones of the story are there, and the performances are there, which is the thing that I'm most happy about. Like, you can understand the moments and get the right kind of empathy from the performances, even in a roughshod state of having, you know, the editing is literally, if someone's talking, they're on camera, there's no creative editing, and the scenes are way longer than they are going to need to be. But it's in a good spot. I'm really happy about it so far.
So what of shooting it was, let's say, easier than you expected? Because I'm sure there's a lot of ways in which it was difficult to shoot this movie on a cruise ship. What surprised you as far as like, oh, that was easier than I thought it would be? Or what came up in that regard?
I think the collaborative process with my creative partner, Trevor Kraft, I honestly think the inception of the idea and the fleshing out of the story was a lot easier than I anticipated, because when I went on my contract, I didn't intend to shoot a movie. I was working on I guess technically still am, but it's on the back burner. I was working on a screenplay that I wanted to make as my first feature. And I was just banging my head against the wall. It's like you put in 3 hours of effort, but you only get, you know, 30 seconds of reward. And it just felt like an uphill battle. And then when Trevor and I started fleshing out the story, it was like we were getting more energy out of it than we were putting into it. And that's when I knew that it was meant to be. And that's actually what it feels like to make real creative progress, because we weren't doing a lot of banging our heads against the wall. So that actually was the easiest, not the easiest, but an easier thing that I anticipated was actually writing the story.
Yeah, I remember talking to you when you were, you know, very passionate about this idea that you assumed would be your first film at the time. And I remember giving you the piece of advice of like, It's very difficult for your first thing to be something that you care that deeply about. It's kind of this, you know, weird bargain where like the thing that means the most to you is always going to be the most difficult. And the thing that you can kind of trick yourself into not caring as much about relative to that other idea, you're going to be more comfortable and you're going to be more yourself. It's going to give you less anxiety. You're going to be in a better place. And so, I give that advice not just to you. I've given that advice to many different people. I kind of relate it metaphorically to, you know, the girl that, like, you think is the, you know, most gorgeous girl in school that you're scared to talk to. You might not have your best first, interaction with a girl with that girl. But if you talk to a girl that's like, yeah, she's cute and like whatever, but like you just don't feel that like ultimate anxiety pressure with, you're going to develop skills with like talking to another human being. And then, you know, when you're able to talk to this like 11 out of 10 like dream girl, you're going to sound more like a human than it had you practice on her to a certain extent. So I use that metaphor in relation to ideas, like your big, big, big idea. It's almost too much pressure for it to be the very first thing, very first feature film that you make. Whereas like there are so many ideas that are just, you can bite off that and chew it and you're not going to die, you know?
Yeah. And to your point, I think the reason why it didn't get made is because I think subconsciously I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do it with my current knowledge, resources, and skill set. When I was, because I, you know, for better or for worse, I like to think big in terms of ideas. And in the back of my head, when I was writing this, I didn't have a network in my the city that I live to actually get it done. I didn't have access to any sort of capital, either from myself or from external sources that I knew that I could draw upon as I was making this. And I just knew that the budget of this film was like 20 times more than I was currently able to put towards a film. And so subconsciously I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this because it's so beyond what I'm capable of doing, which is why when this idea came up, it made perfect sense. And all the resources were there. I had all the locations. I didn't have to spend any money on it. I had all the actors and they were all willing to do it. And the time frame was in such a short window that the almost like the art of it went out the window. I mean, of course there's like creativity, but like the practicality and the demand to get it done in the window trumped the creative side of my brain, which forced me into this non-thinking mode of just doing stuff. And that is what got the film done. I mean, obviously I had times when I was trying to, you know, be creative and think metaphorically and all the things you think when you're making a film. But for the most part, I was like, I have to get this done. If we don't get this done in this window, then I'm going to be a failure. You know, I had to kind of go there and be like, do it, do it, do it, do it.
Yeah. I think the evolution when it comes to making stuff, if I could chart it, it's first, it's ideas that are creative and those are great. And we all love creative ideas. And then as you're getting closer to actually making something, whether it be, you know, your grand idea or something else, your ideas start being more problem solving based and how can I do this based and practicality based. And so like when I'm talking to somebody who's working on something, I can always tell what stage they're at based on what kind of ideas they're having. Like if they're having ideas of like, hey, I could probably shoot this in like 3 weeks before this location goes away forever from me. That's a more actionable idea than wouldn't it be cool if blah, 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 you know, and then there were space lasers and this happened. And then Tom Cruise ran out of this room and was like, hey, man, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's like those are like the baby ideas. And then the more mature ideas are like, hey, this person's really cool and I have them for 2 weeks. I should make something. That's the evolution, I would say. It's like you switch from this dreamer to this very practical person as an artist.
Like an operator.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I agree with that. And that's how it was. I mean, it was as me and Trevor were coming up with it, we were, you know, our main thing was like, well, we don't want to get fired. What can we do that will not get us fired, but if we get in trouble, it's okay. And then we were thinking, you know, okay, well, you know, casting the people that we were working with, and it all just became very practical. Once we found the commonalities between who we were both as people and what we had mutually experienced, and then mining those experiences and kind of finding the happy place and the dark place in our shared experiences. After that, it just became an exercise of, okay, well, what does it look like to take these ideas and these experiences and these feelings to their most extreme, to their logical but surprising conclusion? And then how do we do that without breaking any rules on the cruise ship? And then who that we know will fill these roles to make the expressions of the characters fit the intention. I think it's going well so far.
So tell me a little bit about Trevor, because, you know, any undertaking, you know, you want the right people involved, you want to assemble the right crew or cast or whatever. What was his role in all of this, and how did you kind of choose him to work so closely with on this project?
It was kind of his idea to make something. When we were in the status of repairs on the ship, he had just a silly idea of doing like a film festival scramble where you make a short film over 48 hours. And then I suggested we make a feature. And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, okay, now we have to do it. But the reason that we actually did it, because there's been plenty of talk, you know, you say you're going to do stuff and you never do. But what made me know that he was really the guy that I could count on, because I've had plenty of experiences where you think somebody's the guy and they just let you down. And it, you know, if you don't be careful, it'll make you bitter and untrustworthy of people. But the way that I knew that he was going to be someone that I could count on is because he feels older than he actually is. He's like, I think in his mid-20s, but he sort of acts like he's in his 30s. He's extremely mature. He's kind. He has great emotional intelligence. He's a great actor, and he's a great musician and a great singer. So he just has all this talent. And aside from that, in addition, he's very open to doing things. Because I think not to get into his personal story, because that's not my place to tell it, but I think he's in a point in his life right now where he's wanting to build his character and build his reputation and sort of make good on what it is to be a real professional that has a brand and reputation as someone who can be counted on to do good work. That's sort of where he is in his life. And that echoed and still echoes my sentiment. And so on a baseline, like personality trait level, that's when I knew, okay, he's the guy. And then when we started talking, the more we started talking about the story and who the character was and his understanding of his own demons and my understanding of my own demons, it just became obvious that, like, oh, we're buddies. And really the final thing that I knew, I was like, this is the thing, is that he played me some of his original music. And his original music is, I'm not going to say it's similar to mine, but I'm saying that we could play a show together. We could share a bill together and it would make perfect sense. Like so many people in the Million Dollar Quartet world, the world that I have done for so long, is sort of like everyone's kind of got their take on rockabilly. It's all this like 50s rockabilly type music. But him and I come from a more like progressive rock. Me more like Incubus, John Mayer, Tears for Fears. He's more like My Morning Jacket, Dave Matthews Band type stuff. And when I heard his music and the music that he had, that he was like, hey, I have this song that could be the song in the film. And I listened to it. I was like, oh man, this is like, it's all perfect. Like he has been alive for 26 years for us to both be at this same nexus of where what we both want to do is the same. Our puzzle pieces fit together perfectly. And I just knew, I was like, he's the guy.
That's a better answer than I could have ever even dreamed of. I feel like that can be kind of clipped out to a certain sense, because you really do capture in what you said, what it is to find your partner on a project. And I want to touch on musicality for a moment, because similar to myself, you have a music background, mm-hmm. and I always get excited whenever an actor or a filmmaker has some sort of music background, because I think film can be a very musical medium if you let it be, yes. because even if there isn't a drop of music in the actual film, the rhythm of the images and the rhythm of the dialogue and just how you cut something can have such a musical quality to it. And I think a familiarity with the grammar of music is always going to benefit a performer or a filmmaker. Whatever you're trying to do in regards to film, it will make it better. Tell me a little bit about your music background. I assume that was your first love and how you got into creativity in general.
Yeah, I didn't know I was musical until someone told me I was musical. Ever since I was a kid, I'd been able to hear stuff and pluck it out. The first thing I remember playing by ear was the Forrest Gump theme. And I heard it and I plucked it out on a piano and I showed somebody once and they were like, "You can do that?" I'm like, "Yeah, I thought you could, that's what you could do." So I knew that I had some sort of talent. And then guitar was really easy for me. I remember I was the only, everybody in my class, we took a music elective and I was in, I think, sixth grade, and everybody else struggled. And I was like, "Guys, this is really easy. I don't know why y'all are struggling." And so I've always kind of had a natural tendency to it. But then as I got older, you start realizing that it's everything. Everything is everything. Music, the rules of music and the rhythms of music apply to sound, images, design, everything. And you just have to learn how to transcode it for what you're trying to do. And so when there's a clip that I don't remember where I saw, but it's a clip of Martin Scorsese directing The Irishman, and they're filming behind him and he's watching in Video Village, and Robert De Niro is saying a line, and Martin Scorsese is conducting the line to himself in a rhythm that he knows that Robert De Niro is going to speak it at. And he's just sort of waving his hands in this slow rhythm. And I was like, "That's it, man. He gets it, you know?" But what you said exactly, pictures are rhythms, facial expressions are rhythms. Everything is fractal to how autistic you want to get with it. And so when it comes to, I guess, pacing things, the thing that I am having to learn in this editing, process is the thing that I haven't built the skill at yet is holding the context of the rhythm over such a long piece. Because if I'm editing a short form piece of content or you know playing a song, it's a very short context that you can get for the rhythm of things. And I don't even think my talents for rhythm translate to content. I think I haven't really had a lot of content that's blown up, because to me, there's different tools at play. But with regards to film, that's the thing I do have to learn is understanding how the rhythm in the first scene affects the rhythm in the last scene, and being able to sort of hold all that in my head. That's my answer for that.
Yeah, I would say a feature film is basically an album, and it's comprised of songs, of course, and the scenes yes. are songs, but groupings of scenes can be songs as well. You know, it's right. it's never as literal as the scene ends and then the song ends. I think one of the beautiful things that DVD brought to the world is the idea of chapters in regards to a film, because until that point, people thought of chapters in regards to books and literature. And when you are faced with a sheet inside the DVD case that says, "Oh, these are the chapters of the film," somebody had to make those choices. Maybe a filmmaker put that off onto somebody else because they didn't want to think about it, because that would give them an existential crisis to start thinking about their film in terms of chapters, because maybe that's just not the way that they approach it. But somebody had to think all right, how many chapters is Terminator 2 versus some other movie or whatever? And I mentioned Terminator 2 because I remember in regards to James Cameron's films, I would look at like the chapter list on the DVD and it would be like 50 or 60 chapters, you know, like he was very like everything's a chapter, like, you know, and other filmmakers, sometimes it would be like 5 or 6 chapters or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, when you start thinking in that regard, you realize like, oh, these are songs. These are the tracks of the album that is the movie. And so I'm very grateful for DVD for helping people almost think about that in a certain way. It's kind of this unsung heroic part of that chapter of imbibing movies.
Yeah. And I have two questions for you. First, how do you, this first question is two parts. How do you decide which parts of your films are chapters? And is it the same for every film? And two, I forget, do you put chapters on your YouTube uploads, your movies on YouTube?
No, I don't do it on YouTube. I don't know why I don't do it on YouTube. I think it's just, you know, laziness or just not wanting to do it. But when I make a DVD of my film, usually I'm figuring out the chapters in that regard. And then when I'm actually making a movie itself, the chapter aspect is all happening unconsciously. Like it's just the way that I think of pacing. It's going to be very different for, let's say, like a 45-minute movie like No Job or Apocalypse Beach. I think of that almost as like one chapter. I think of that as just like itself. That's kind of how I approach it. It's just a long piece of writing. But something like No Shark, I don't think I would ever even have even finished that film if I didn't think of each beach as a chapter. Because that was just like, it was such an undertaking, more so than anyone would even realize. Because I think the pace at which she read the narration for that film was very fast, and it's because she's a very fast talker. But there's a version of that film that is probably like 4 hours or more if it was just a slower paced talker. So, you know, that plays into it as well. So what I mean is the characters and the actors that you're dealing with, their natural rhythm becomes part of the rhythm of the film. You almost can't, and you wouldn't want to force that out of them. You don't want a slower talker to talk fast just because you have this weird expectation of the film. You have to figure out a way in which the slowness goes along with the fastness of what you're doing, much in the same way that, like, you know, a bass line might be quarter notes, and, you know, there might be some guitar melody that's like all like 16ths or 30 mm-hmm. seconds or whatever. It's just, it's all going in concert and it's all working together. But one musician can be playing at a lot slower pace than another. But you're not thinking about that when you're listening to the song, because it's just all going together. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's kind of how I think of it, is how fast and how slow, and what are the rhythms of the people in the film? Because that's going to help me kind of cut the scenes and cut everything. Because I think that's how you find an organic rhythm for what you're doing. Like, you never want your style to be imposed upon these wonderful, beautiful people that you've hired and brought on. You don't want to bend them too much to your will. I think that can be kind of the problem with some of Wes Anderson's more recent work, is I feel like there's such a formula that's been established. And Tim Burton, sometimes that happens with some of his work. Certain filmmakers that have such a specific rhythm and way of doing things, that everybody who's going to be in one of their movies, they've already seen 10 movies by that person. So they're in their brain, they can just kind of do whatever that is. But
whether or not they're suited for it, is that what you're saying?
Right. But also, I don't think the imitation of it is necessarily what it is at its best. I think
yes,
the pure version of a Wes Anderson film that you find in his earlier work, that's really the best. You know, it's not a copy of a copy of a copy, to a certain extent. And I'm not trying to you know, single him out, because I think it can happen to anybody who's worked on a lot of different things. Luckily, it's never happened to me, because I think I change up the kind of movies I make a lot. Like, I'm never like doing the exact same thing like 10 times in a row or whatever. But yeah, that's an aspect of as well. A very long-winded answer to an honest question.
Now, that makes sense. The way talking about the pace of people's speech as rhythms makes a lot of sense, because what I've experimented with, and I'm going to keep doing as I actually get into the edit of this, is with one scene I experimented, I did this practically because the way that I recorded audio was so unlike how I would do it if I actually knew that I was going to have to record audio for a movie. So it all kind of, I had this directional mic. I didn't have a boom. It was like a Casey Neistat mic that I had that, you know, the person who was speaking had to be on camera because I didn't really have the means to record off-camera dialogue like that. So what I did for a scene is that I turned off the video on the timeline and I just cut the audio, and I would just listen to the pace of the audio. And then when that would feel good, I would turn the audio off and then edit the scene for video only, and then paying only attention to their face and knowing what the beats were. And so when I would see someone either react or speak, and I wasn't paying attention to the words that they were saying per se, I was paying attention to how the audience would react to the facial expressions. And then I would turn them both on and just see what that did, and then tweak as I needed. It's sort of the idea of, you know, like you write a drum part, and then you're like, okay, well, I have this guitar part that I wrote that's cool. Let's see how we can fit them together. You know?
Yeah, a lot of times in editing, I feel like I'm cleaning up the performance to a certain extent. I'm just, you know, something goes on just a little too long as far as a pause, and I can just kind of truncate that pause to some extent. And like, yeah, you know, these are all, I'm basically turning a B acting performance into an A+ acting performance, even if it was an A+ to begin with, just because there's always something that you can judge in a certain direction where, like, somebody, I forget who said it, once said that, great acting is really mostly just great editing to a certain extent.
Frances McDormand said that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's, and a lot of people have reached that conclusion, because I think there is truth to it. As much as I love actors and what they bring me, I think I'm honoring them. You know, I'm not slogging them off and saying they're imperfect, because I think it's you're supposed to give something imperfect at that stage. And then later on, that's when it gets honed.
Yeah, it's like the actor is a really high quality piece of wood.
Yeah.
In a sense. And it's like you give it to a carpenter, and the carpenter is like, this is freaking perfect. I'm going to build the best treehouse out of this you ever seen, you know? And I would actually like to go, I'm not going to do this, but somebody might. I think it'd be interesting to go through all the best actor and actress, even best, any sort of the best actor categories, main or supporting, and note how many of them thank the editor.
Mm.
Probably like less than 1%. I'd be surprised if it was 10 people who thank the editor of the film.
Yeah, it's makeup to a certain extent. It's lighting and makeup, editing is, to a certain extent. I would say too, you know, when it comes to performances, I don't know if you've noticed this. It's always been apparent to me is that when you are acting on screen, you don't really have your eyes and your ears to a certain extent as far as like how you look and how you sound. Really, you know, you're in it with the other actor or the other actors. You don't really know what you look like. I find that the director's role is being the eyes and the ears of the actor to a certain extent, where it's like the actor's subjective reality of what they need to get into in order to perform what you're asking has nothing to do with the objective reality of what the mic is capturing or the camera is capturing or the staging or are they in their light or whatever it may be. The director's role is to worry about all those other things. I'm just curious, your experience with that, working on this film on the cruise ship. I know you perform in the film as well. how did you kind of like be your own eyes and ears? Because I found tricks with my own work when I'm in it to kind of figure that out. But what was your approach in that sense?
Well, actually, I didn't perform. I didn't play a character in the film.
Oh, okay. I totally got that wrong then.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I think I'm going to play a character, but they're only going to be heard over voice. And the reason I did that is there were a couple people who were like, why don't you play a part? And I'm like, I don't have the bandwidth to do that right now. You know, I got to focus on the other people. And I don't necessarily trust, I don't know another person that I was working with at the time who could do the camera work that I needed to be done. Because the camera that I worked with was very fickle. The thing is, yeah. But I don't know, man. That was probably something that, if I'm being completely honest, fell through the cracks a little more times than I would like, because I'd never done it before at this scale, and I was so focused on getting it done, and I didn't have the muscle to kind of hold all the information in my head at all times, that I know there were some things that slipped through the cracks from an acting perspective, that I didn't see in real time. There were things that I did, but, I don't really know how to answer that question. I was trying my best to pay attention.
You did approach it to a certain extent because you realized, like, there's no way I'm going to act in this thing.
Yeah.
You know? That probably saved you in many ways you'll never even know. That was like probably a bullet that you dodged like crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is an approach. It's like, oh, what's the easiest way to avoid that? Oh, just not be in it. You know, sometimes the most, you know, wide sweeping obvious solution is just the solution at the time to a certain extent. But you do have a performance background. I want to get into that. I know you do want to act in some of your projects and do that sort of thing. So what is your relationship to acting? And we know your relationship to music, but as an actor, how do you see yourself and the kind of things that you want to do or have done?
Well, to be honest, I haven't really thought about myself in the third person like that too much. And it's probably something I should start doing a little bit more, not a lot more, but a little bit more as I enter kind of an unknown phase of this next portion of my career, for the purpose of just kind of getting an idea of how I want to design what I want to do. But, I don't know. There was a theater company in Birmingham, Alabama, where I was born and currently live, called Summerfest, and it was a summer stock theater, meaning they only did shows during the summer. And this theater company would have a youth workshop every summer for 2 weeks, and you could go and you could learn about all phases of performing from more of a theater perspective, you know, dancing, acting, singing. We learned about lighting, like we learned how to find your light. But like, I was like, I think as a kid, I was probably like 12 years old, like 12 to 18, I did it. And it kind of just baked in the language of performing into my bones a little bit. And I just enjoyed acting, even though I didn't really have any quote formal training. Like I never went to school for it per se. But I just enjoyed the process of getting into somebody else's head and body and being someone else and then being a vessel to tell a story that I could completely lose myself in. Like I played, the majority of my career, I played this guy named Carl Perkins, who was a rockabilly guy. I've played Buddy Holly, but one of my favorite things that I ever did was play this character, Bat Boy. There's a musical called Bat Boy, and it's based on the Weekly World News Bat Boy stories that you'd see at the grocery store aisles. And that was sort of the first time I ever learned, like, oh, you can like literally be something different. It's not just about playing other people. It can be about playing other life forms. And that was fun. And I kind of just chased the fun of it. Only recently have I ever really gotten into the formal ideas of like what it is to be a quote actor. It really was just about what's on the page how do I express that? And how do I do what the director wants me to do? And then if I do a good job, I can do it again later. It has really been that bonehead simple. But if I look forward into the future and what I want to do, it's honestly, to be honest, I'd have to kind of think about it. I haven't really thought too much about that question. I know there's an answer in there, but I like characters that are complicated. I like characters that have a kind of a happy darkness about them, where there's sort of a darkness boiling underneath. Probably it sometimes can reflect my own life, but and I could also see myself being a character actor. I don't really fit the role of a straight like ingenue, although I can do it, but I see actors like Gary Oldman, and I'm like, man, that's got to be fun. You know, that must be a lot of fun to do, as opposed to like a Jason Statham or a Rock or even like Tom Hanks. He kind of just does. It's almost weird when he plays a character in some ways, because we see him as Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I think the audience kind of chooses those people like for
yes.
you. In the best versions, let's say, of that, because there have been definitely periods of history where like people tried to inflict a leading man who's always playing themselves on the audience, and the audience is just like, yeah, not him, you know, not that guy. I think it's the audience has to request it to a certain extent, and
which is why I think I haven't thought about it too much, because first of all, I haven't had a lot of diversity in my acting, because for the past 10 years I've been doing the same show, playing the same character, but people have enjoyed it, so I just kept doing it. But to your point, I feel there's a part of me that's like, oh well, I will do what the audience wants me to do, in a sense, you know, and we'll see what comes next with that.
Yeah, and the other side of it too is like, I've only been made a better filmmaker by acting, and I've only, like, I think everything informs everything else. I can talk to actors better because I know what it's like to act. You know, I think a lot of the negative reputation that filmmakers can have sometimes is when they shut themselves off to other parts of the creative process. You don't talk to somebody the same way if you don't really know what it is to do what they do. I was listening to a podcast just the other day with a filmmaker that I really do enjoy, that I really do like, Mike Lee, who's done a number of excellent, you know, just great, very actor-friendly films, right? You know, movies that I just think are just like, God, like Naked and Life is Sweet, and just all these wonderful films that I just think are just like perfect pieces of acting and just very natural, that style. Anyway, all this to say, the second he started talking about like having a cinematographer and everything, it became very clearly that like, if it were up to him to lens a film and shoot a film, he would have no idea what he was doing. He would have less of an idea than like a 5-year-old as far as like using a camera. Like it like literally nothing. And that kind of disappointed me to a certain extent, because I do think that the most healthy relationships you can have as a filmmaker will be the ones where you know kind of what you're asking for, you know, kind of how a shot needs to be shot and what is too much to ask out of a camera or a lens or whatever, you know, like that kind of thing. You just need to, almost like you're building a house, it always serves to know a little bit about plumbing and a little bit about flooring and a little bit, just enough to know if somebody, if you're at A, you're asking somebody too much, or B, if they're ripping you off and just telling you bullshit. You know, you just need to know these things. I just think it improves all the interactions when somebody knows that you're not just totally in the dark and asking them just like weird, like almost king-like, just go do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, absolutely. One of my YouTube videos, I don't know whether it was a YouTube video or a short that I cut out of it, someone commented and they were like, I don't think this is a a healthy thing to ask people to do, to shoot a feature film by themselves or with zero or little crew, because film is a collaborative medium. And I was like, yes, it is, but I needed to do it by myself because I wanted to know what it's like to have to do everything. Because again, like, hopefully in my next project, I can have at least one or two people help me from a technical standpoint. But to your point, I mean, you laid it out perfectly. If I don't know how to do everything, even if I can't do everything as well as I could, you got to know how to do it all. I mean, like, I've heard stories, there've been many stories of filmmakers who I've either made a film by themselves or they've worked in kind of a, you know, the commercial world where they kind of had to do everything by themselves in a very small way. And it can only help. Yeah. It's weird. That's weird that, I don't know. And I think at a certain point, if you like have a career as a filmmaker and you can make all these films, wouldn't you want, out of just natural curiosity, at least for a couple hours, to you get a cinematographer and be like, hey, show me what you, how to do this. Show me how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, it's that Orson Welles clip of him being like, a cinematographer can teach you everything there is to know about the camera in a half a day.
Yes. That's a great quote. I don't distinctly remember that. So I'm going to put that in my pocket. I really like that.
Yeah. Cause he basically was saying that, like, all this mystique around this, like, the cinematography and everything, he was like, it's not as cryptic as everyone makes it out to be. It's not as hard as everyone makes it out to be. All this stuff is very simple. And I'm to piggyback on that, I've heard another quote that, like, learning where to put the camera and learning the technical aspects of filmmaking, that's the easy part. Deciding what to make films about, that's the real job.
Yeah. And also, there are only, like, maybe sometimes two places to put the camera in where you're shooting on a given day sometimes. Like, I think people, when they first think about filmmaking, they're thinking about, like, infinite choices in all situations. And when you start making a movie, you realize it's very finite, almost binary choices that you're making,
yeah,
on a particular day, or no choices at all sometimes.
Yeah. What's your process for discovering where to put the camera? Because I ask this because a lot of your films, like, when I look at, quote, filmmakers on YouTube, and I say quote filmmakers because they're really people who have just made commercials their entire career and they have a cinema camera and they just shoot things that look like Nike ads and call it quote films, which to me is, it's not the proper word usage, but you know the look that I'm talking about. Your films look different than that. And you are I would say, a actual filmmaker making cinema, narrative stories, blah, blah, blah. So, because your process and the images that you create feel so different than many of the other, quote, filmmakers on the platform, what's your process for deciding whether or where to put the camera?
That's a great question. I think it, if I could reduce it down to something very simple first, and then I'll go into more detail. I would say that, like, the kind of filmmaking that you're referring to, like, let's say the content-oriented, almost commercial side of it, where it's about how can we mimic what we see around us, regardless of, you know, whether we actually care or not. You know, like, how can we seem professional? How can we get gigs where we will be taken seriously professionally? That kind of approach. I think what differentiates my work from that kind of work is that when I look at that work, because I've done what I've done and because I've made the films that I've made, when I look at that work and I see the images being captured and the ways that they're being captured, I don't believe them that they find that beautiful. I think that they are trying to fit in more than they are trying to share their taste with the world. You know, if somebody doesn't like one of my movies, there's no way for them to inject into their negative review or inject into their hot take, and I don't believe that he actually finds these things beautiful. Like, nobody would make that argument. Like, if the way that I shoot is a very specific sensibility to me, You know, I find these shots beautiful, and I find these faces beautiful, and I find this style that I'm using for this film beautiful. Like, whatever it is, it's just like, it's an honest exchange. You know, I'm not asking anybody to sit through anything that I don't love to a certain extent. And I think from that, just that kernel of love and of aesthetic sensibility grows your style and what kind of stories you want to tell, sure, but the visuals, the people you choose, etc., it all grows from, I genuinely find blah, blah, blah beautiful. And that can be a drape. It's not always going to be, you know, some beautiful actress. Sometimes it can just be like the wood on a floor or a wall or something like that. It's just something you genuinely connect to. Whereas, you know, these filmmaker in quotes filmmakers on YouTube sometimes, and I'm not talking about fellow YouTube filmmakers like me or Dan Lotz or Joel Haver. I'm talking about like what you mean, like the content driven, here's how to be a filmmaker in five steps kind of guys or whatever.
Yes.
You know, they're just, it's different choices and different reasons, and it's just kind of, it's conformity masquerading as professionalism to a certain extent. Whereas to me, I think I'm being a professional by being true to my own sense of beauty. You know, I'm not trying to sell anybody a vacuum cleaner. I really do think and believe all of these things, not just my theories on how films should be made, but like just what I'm capturing and why. And when I watched movies growing up and continue to watch movies, I'm picking out those things subconsciously that I think are more beautiful than the other things in the film. And I just take that with me. And then when the situation calls for it, I can take that out of my pocket. And that's a way that I can solve a problem.
Hmm.
So because I've watched the amount of, let's say, Japanese films or Korean films or whatever that I've watched, you know, when I am presented with a quiet moment or a solitary moment, I'm going to handle that in a different way than somebody who hasn't internalized that. You know, I'm going to plop the camera down as my initial instinct, you know, whereas somebody else who hasn't really internalized that film grammar to a certain extent might decide to shoot in 120 frames per second and slow it down and just do this kind of like slow spin around the person as they're walking or whatever it may be. Like, that's a totally different approach. And it's solutions to problems that the person doesn't have who's trying to make something creative. Like, these are commercial solutions to a certain extent that have nothing to do with telling a cinematic story over the course of 90 minutes.
Yes.
You know, what works in like a 30-second like sizzle thing to like promote yourself or to impress kids who don't know anything on YouTube, that's not storytelling to a certain extent. Like, that's something you try and skip over when it suddenly appears on your YouTube as an ad. Like, you it's like, I don't know why people put so much time and effort into amassing technology and equipment and stuff and learning these techniques just to create the stuff that people want to or do skip over in between what they're actually trying to watch.
100%. And that's why it's, that's a really good way to put it. And I think I mentioned this to you when we had lunch in New York last year. It's like, if I get to a point in future projects when I can work with a legit cinematographer, because that's not my strength. One of my first criteria is like, how many commercials have you done? And the more commercials the person has done, the less likely I'm going to be to hire them, because I just don't want to work with a cinematographer who has that as their default set of tools. Because it's just not going to look like a movie. It's going to look like a commercial. And I just haven't seen very many examples of a cinematographer who can switch back and forth between the two modes and it feel different. it's either his movies look like commercials, and it usually doesn't go the other way around. It usually doesn't go the other way around where like a cinematographer can make a commercial look like a movie because it's different requirements. That makes perfect sense. And with regards to the YouTube stuff about, you know, putting all the work into stuff that's going to be, skipped over, it's one of the reasons that the stuff that I have made on YouTube is the quote content. I think we may have a kind of a different relationship with like what content is and what are, as a filmmaker. And that's a whole separate conversation. But I'm finding myself as I make future YouTube videos that aren't films, my videos / content getting simpler and simpler and simpler, because I'm like, if I have a finite amount of time to spend, I want to spend the most of it on my film as possible, which means that any sort of video that I put on YouTube as a way to leverage my personal brand, I need to spend as little time on it as possible. Like find that like Goldilocks zone between like what's going to give the most value to people who actually want to watch these videos and what's going to give me the most time to actually work on my film and not be one of those guys, which I've been before, of you end up making content on YouTube and then you're like, I'm spending more time making content about the thing that I'm making as opposed to making the thing that I want to make and then using some content now and then to leverage it.
Yeah, content in the good sense of it is exactly what we're doing right now, right? So we're somebody's listening to this, whether it be when it goes up or years from now, and they're gaining something from it. I just think of content in the most charitable sense as just, you know, educational media or, you know, whatever it may be. Like it's there was a great changeover, a great switchover of what we used to call media just became what we call, the word media became content at a certain point for whatever mm-hmm. reason. It just became a change in parlance. Content in the negative sense is, yeah, like you're describing, where it becomes, it takes over the majority of your output to a certain extent, and it almost becomes... you as an artist becomes secondary to you as a content creator. Or if you are creating content, it's got like maybe a sprinkle of art to it, and it's mostly slop to a certain extent. I'm not saying you. I'm saying like
no. I get it.
Yeah, I think the formula is different. So like, you know, when I'm talking to you right now and I'm recording this and everything, all that's in my mind is, I'm having a conversation with somebody who I want to have a conversation with. You know, that's the purity of it. And I know that the microphone's working correctly and mm-hmm. and et cetera. Whereas there are plenty of people who, when they're making a podcast, even something as just simple as just two people talking, they're thinking about, oh, what can I clip out? Or what can I, you know, how can I have like a gotcha moment? Or how can I have like some viral thing? Like it becomes, you're putting the cart before the horse to a certain extent. I think those are the aspects that have given content a bad name, but they've also given media a bad name in the past as well.
Yeah. Well, the thing is too, that has also made people a lot of money, and that's where the conundrum comes in.
Yes, but I do think that that's deceptive, because I, you know, if you go by, let's say I don't know, the most profitable or the most long lasting talk shows, and you're, let's say people are talking for 2 minutes or 3 minutes at a time, whether it be like, you know, I remember watching little bits of Dr. Phil on my TV, and like the thing that frustrated me the most about that show, other than that it sucked, was just that like, every 2 minutes, there was like a commercial, and it was always right when something would start getting interesting. So it was like, oh, somebody starts to say something that's like a good point, and then he's like, we'll be right back. And like, that was just so grating to me that I did not watch the show at a certain point. And then that encourages a type of viewer who is so beaten down by entertainment that they will, A, put up with that. It's almost like an abusive relationship that you're having with the thing that you're watching. and or B, they're not paying attention to what they're watching at all, and they're just doing other stuff, and it's just background noise to them. So I think these are the ways that art forms and genres get subverted, right? Because there's something so pure about a great talk show. You know, when I'm watching old clips, I don't even think Dick Cavett's like the best interviewer, and I don't even think Larry King is the best interviewer. I think they're kind of idiots to a certain extent, but that helps them to a certain extent. Like, I think that was their angle and their way in as an interviewer. And
well, it's almost like they're taking the point of view of the audience.
Yes, yes. There's an approach to interviewing, which is, I know absolutely nothing. And you can make Borat with that, or you can be Dick Cavett. Like, that's just kind of like an approach. But I'll watch old clips, and like, man, conversations would drag out, and like, they would breathe in the way that podcasts are. So it's kind of like, I think the give and take and like the peaks and valleys of a particular form of media, what we're experiencing with content, where the cart is put before the horse and the conformity is put before the informational and entertainment aspects of something, where it's, oh, everybody's doing it this way, so we better update our software to that, without even thinking of what we might be losing by doing that. What, you know, these aspects were like, I do think that like the injection of burnt in subtitles was a very strange development for me personally when I started to see burnt in subtitles that were incorrect, like AI generated text where I know what word is being spoken and the word on the screen is not that. That really sent up a lot of red flags for me in regards to content, because I know that because I've done this research, because it's just a proclivity of mine, it's just an interest of mine, there are behavioral science experiments where you do just that to people. You tell them a word auditorily, and you present a similar word in text, and you see what they are going to process. So there are these ways that, like, I do think that people can be...
Or do you think they're just hiring some kid from the Philippines who does it and doesn't, you know, or like, are they're using AI and just not checking it, I guess.
Just not checking it. And yeah. Also, I do think that literacy has gone down like crazy to a certain point. And I think some of it gets blamed on the educational system and should, and some of it gets blamed on COVID. But I do think that if kids are consuming content where the subtitles are straight up wrong as compared to what is being said, I think that helps turn you into kind of a zombie to a certain extent. So I, you know, to bring this all back, I really do think approach is everything, and compromise is going to destroy the best of things, and also the stuff that was teetering on being trash to begin with, like an episode of Dr. Phil or whatever. Like, some things are closer to toppling over than other things. I would say the kind of films that I make are, I start from such a far away place as far as like the compromises that I would make. Like, it's never gonna like flip. Like, somebody isn't gonna watch one of my movies and be like, holy shit, what the fuck. Like, it's just it would be completely the opposite of what I do to a certain extent. Whereas I think when you play at the fringes of like, this is trash, or like, this is passable, like, I think most entertainment plays in that, like, it's really just a hair's breadth away from like, this is a waste of my time. I try to not play in that area, whereas most of society and most of entertainment, particularly in what could be called like the content consuming area, it's teetering. It's like just good enough that you don't hate it, but it, you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
I know what you, it makes, well, it has to be, like, if you show just an average person, like AI, okay, here's an example. The types of content that I would see working on a cruise ship, see people from like, and again, this is all just generalities. This isn't indicative of an actual, like, entire country's content preference or behavior or whatever. But I would see the types of content I would see Americans watch, types of content I would see like people from other countries watch is very different. And so like the kind of I would see the most abhorrent slop or hear the most abhorrent slop coming from people's phones. And I would be like, how do they just live there? Like, how do they live with themselves? Like listening to this stuff every day, every free moment of their time, they're giving their mind this just stuff that's like probably literally making them dumber. But I think that's different. I think America is probably a little different, but I don't know, man. I have a weird relationship with it because I understand it. And there's a lot of content that I watch that is slop, that's funny. Like I'm a real sucker for videos of cats doing stupid stuff. Like I'm a sucker for it. It's fast food. It's M&Ms. It's sugar for my brain. And I understand that, but I also know that like, it's probably better for me to eat vegetables, but like, well, what's vegetable content? Like, what does that look like? And I think, you know, just as you can look at the obesity rates of America from a physical health standpoint, you can also look at the obesity rates for America when it comes to mental health. And the stuff that we're putting in our brains is just as destructive on a mental level than the stuff that we're putting in our bodies. And when I started like looking at it like that, I'm like, oh, well, I don't want to watch TikTok, even though people have made a lot of money on it. And that's a whole separate debate. But, and then what I think, okay, well, I don't have a studio backing me. And this is kind of where my whole philosophy comes with content in terms of like me as an independent filmmaker is that I don't have Warner Brothers or Universal or Paramount making advertisements and marketing on my behalf. So I have to do something to get my name out there because otherwise no one is going to know who I am. So what does that look like? You know, how far down the common, how low IQ do I want to go with it? And there's probably a world in which I could make some super low IQ slop, like find a way to do that and probably be a little bit more successful, like over the long term than trying to like stick to my principles. And you can see kind of who succeeds over the long term you can tell people are doing stuff that's below their principles. And so when it comes to or maybe it is their principles, but their principles aren't as moral as I would like them to be or whatever, personal preference. So, but I guess that's for me, the eternal question with making content and using it as a means to leverage my true desires to build a catalog, a reputation and a business as a filmmaker. And I'm still trying to figure that out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the piece of advice that I would give and also give to myself constantly is that the audience is always more intelligent and more savvy than you think they are.
Yeah.
Like they get things in 2 seconds that sometimes I assume it'll take them like 2 minutes to get. Like it really is quite amazing. And I think certain people have bet in the opposite direction to what most people bet on. Like I think the rise of the 3-hour, 4-hour podcast is something nobody predicted other than the people who literally just did it because that's what they wanted to do.
Yes.
You know, like the Joe Rogans of the world, you know, they were just like, well, I just want to do this. Like, and I'm going to trust that as like the reason why it should be done. So I think I really do think that if you elevate the audience through thinking of them as just as intelligent as you are, that's a hell of an approach as well. Like I don't mm-hmm. think I don't think of people as lowest common denominator. I think of them to a certain extent as like you know, undernourished or they don't know what they don't know and they haven't been exposed to blah, 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 blah. It's, and I'm not saying that you're deriding them. I'm just saying that like, I think that every person that I've ever really, really like genuinely had a conversation with, because I think there's a lot of people, it's very impossible to have a genuine conversation with them because they're just so far gone in some direction. Like we've mm-hmm. all met those people
yes.
in life.
Yes.
Every person that you can genuinely have like a really actual connection, even if it's only for a few seconds or whatever it is, you see their soul to a certain extent. You're getting a glimpse of that. And you're realizing that like the core of them is very similar to the core of you. It's just expressing itself in different ways, and it had different experiences, and we are all the same, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, yeah. there's a Buddhist approach, there's a Christian approach. There's,
yeah.
Everybody's talking about the same thing, right? So I, you know, much as people like, let's say, people say like, oh, I want to produce content that, you know, there's no cursing and there's no sex and there's no violence, you know, like, I think that's like a, it's a very rudimentary, version of what I'm talking about. Like, I'm talking about a more elevated version of it in the sense that, like, I don't want to make anything that a soul can't be reached by to a certain extent. Like, I don't want to make anything that is going to put somebody further away from who they are at their core, like, really, as like this wonderful being that was once a baby and then became a teenager and then became an adult or whatever it may be. It's like, you know, part of the reason why I do the podcast in the way that I do, I don't stuff it with ads, because I, as a soul, cringe whenever I'm listening to something that I am enjoying. And then it's like, hey, by the way, you should be betting on sports. You know what I mean? Like, that's, it infuriates me, because it's like, is that really what you think about me? Like, you're having this wonderful conversation for my benefit and for all of our benefit, but you think of me as somebody who should be betting on fucking sports.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I thought we were having a connection here, like Joe Rogan. Like, no, like, what are we doing? Like, am I on your level or am I not? But, like, I want to be treated with respect as an audience member. So I try and treat my audience members with respect, whether it's the films I make, the podcast I make. You know, there's a way, there's a podcast that you can do. I don't know what that podcast is. There is a podcast that you can do. There's a podcast that anybody can do. You just find your way in. I find that if you do something pure in that regard, like, you can find that balance between the promotional stuff that you produce and the art that you are promoting.
Yeah, I that's a really good way to put it, and I think you put it more empathetically than I did, in terms of saying it's not about the common denominator. Everyone has their soul in their eyes. And that's a much more empathetic way to put it than I did. And I guess what I mean by the lowest common denominator is that, you know, to your point, you said, oh, people may be undernourished or undereducated, and they need, you know, there's something that they could interact with that would raise their consciousness. I guess what I mean when I talk about the hierarchy of whatever is, it's like, do I want to meet people at the level of a lowered consciousness and not try to raise their consciousness? So I think there are there's a lot of stuff out there that, like, to your point, doesn't try to raise people's consciousness. It actively either keeps it at the same or it tries to lower it. And then that's how they get in there and they do whatever they need to do, whatever their call to action is. And, you know, again, this is where it's the conundrum, because, like, I would love to make a full-time living doing this. I think that's a great way. I'd much rather be doing that than making a job. And so you have to find the ways that are authentic to you to be able to essentially monetize what you're doing, but still keep it true to your soul. Like, some of my favorite stuff on YouTube is just, there's this guy named Gerald Peters. He trades stocks, and he's all about, like, you know, learning how to, you know, turn your financial situation around no matter how much money you're making every year. That's sort of his thing. But his videos are just like him in front of a whiteboard talking about his philosophy on money and lifestyle when it comes to, like, trading stocks and making money. And there's no edits. And his editing is actually sometimes, like, objectively bad when he tries to edit. But there's an endearing quality to it that you're like, oh, this is a real person. And, like, I could go to New Orleans and find his house and just knock on his door and hang out with him. Maybe not that, but you know what I mean. And so I'm like, well, that's probably the stuff that I want to be making. The stuff that I'm naturally drawn to. Like, I've flirted with the idea of making, like, the high concept content. And every time I try to do it, I just want to end it all. It drains my soul.
Yeah. I would say, the best way to explain the way to create something, lowest common denominator, it's a weird term, but, like, I'll use that term because I think it's beneficial in this sense, is, you look at certain comedies that they do kind of, by the end of it, you've taken in more message and more deepness than you thought you did or would ever even remember that you did. Like, they're, the great comedies all have some other thing going on in there that is kind of enhancing the comedy to a certain extent, because yes. a lot of comedy is, you know, in furtherance of, it just needs that thrust. Like, one of my favorite comedies of all time is Tommy Boy with Chris Farley and David Spade.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie 20, 30 times. I adore that film. All the comedic moments I love, but also there are things that are done dramatically in that film that I would put up there with some of the best actual literal drama films I've ever seen. Like, there's just moments that I just think, and I think comedy is just being the delivery system for, man, like, you cannot come away from Tommy Boy not thinking that, like, man, Chris Farley had range. You know what I mean? Like, just him talking about his dad in a fucking boat is just like, no, this dude was on like another level, and we lost somebody truly great. And it's one thing to think we lost somebody truly great because he made me laugh and blah, blah, blah. It's another thing to be like, oh, we were only getting like a small fraction of what this guy was capable of. So I would say that comedy is the best way to please people on a very quick level. Like, it's you're reacting to the jokes or you're reacting to the funny moment in the moment. And then the what you're getting from it from the beginning of the film to the end of the film, by watching the entire thing, you're getting something else entirely. You're getting a story about a family, or you're getting a story about duty, or you're getting something about that if somebody sat you down and tried to explain, like, here's why doing this is important or whatever, you know, like, when you watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the entire purpose of that film is to explain why it's good sometimes to take somebody home for the holidays and share your family with them. You know, it's here's all these things going wrong, but by the end of the film, nobody wants Steve Martin to just go home alone. Nobody. And they've been annoyed by this other character in a million ways, but they've also found him endearing, etc. But the purpose of that film is to get you to the point of, hey, this really annoying character who has a little twinkle in his eye too, sure, but here's why it's good to open your home to people. Like, that's the message of the film. I don't think that film would work without all those other comedic moments that work on a very quick level. So how does this go back to content and what you're creating and all that stuff? I think, you know, the best at it that I know is Joel Haver. You know, like, he made these like comedic shorts, and that's not going to be everybody's way in because some people just don't want to do that. But he was able to make these shorts that like made people laugh every week. You know, every week there was a new skit that was on his channel that people could connect to and be like, oh, that was really funny. And that, for some reason, that builds so much trust. I think humor builds so much trust. I think it's just like, if you can make somebody laugh, you're in, kind of thing. It's like the thing they talk about with girls. Like, if you can make a girl laugh, you can make them fill in the blank. I don't want to get this. I don't want to, you know, turn this podcast into something that suddenly somebody turns off and like, oh my God, they got real filthy there. They were, you know, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there is that version of that, which is like, I really do think it, everybody would tell you if you were doing public speaking, like the points in which you make the audience laugh is, what they're going to take away from it. And anything that you're trying to tell them, they will, take that too, but they won't know that they took it. And so they're going to take it on a deeper level because they don't even know that they're carrying it. It's like luggage that has no weight to it, that's invisible. Like, they're bringing that home with them from the conference or whatever, like the intent of what you were saying. But in their mind, they're just thinking, oh man, that guy was funnier than the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's all they're thinking. They're just like, oh yeah, that guy had some good jokes. Whatever. It's just such a great delivery system. So I think humor, and I'll say it myself, like humor is something that like I have totally vastly underutilized in my quote unquote career. Like I've always been a funny person. I've always loved comedy. I am good at it. Like I've killed on stage before, you know, like I've hit all those benchmarks. But it's something that I very rarely inject into the quote-unquote content that I do on YouTube or whatever. And I don't know why. I think it's just that like by the time I decide to make something like that, something vaguely promotional or some piece of content, I'm just not in a space where I won't feel like being funny for whatever reason.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. And I think if I can find a way, or if you can find a way, to when I'm feeling like I want to be funny or I'm feeling funny or whatever, turn on the camera or turn on the microphone or whatever, you know, when I have that spark of performance that's humorous, if I can create in those moments, those spaces, I think I or you or anybody else will be a much better, it will have a much easier time at creating, whether it be memorable content or promotional material or whatever it may be. It's just like,
yeah,
it's the time you create and when you decide to turn the camera on or the mic on to a certain extent.
Yeah. The thing that you made, I forget what it's called, but you made some piece of content about like a rapper with some sort of like glottal speech impediment.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was like legit funny. I was like, that's really funny. But it looked like you just had an idea and just recorded it real quick and put it on YouTube.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I did.
But yeah, it's very funny. It's very funny. The thing is, I don't find myself, my wife says I'm funny because the only time my style of humor is more silly and it's sort of like goofing around with people in the moment about something that's happening as opposed to crafted jokes or witty comebacks. So for me, it's like hard to kind of turn a camera on when I'm doing it because by the time I turn a camera on, the moment's passed. And so that's something I gotta work on. But I think it's not that I consider myself funny, but sometimes when I get passionate about things and I start being real with things to people start laughing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What you call that?
You're a natural straight man, dude. And straight men are the people always think of like straight men as supporting like the funnier guy or the sillier guy. It's the opposite. It's 50-50, bro. Like for real. It's the straight man can be just as funny as the person who's like, "Hey, look over here."
So, you know, but again, that goes back to our, you know, you talk about being an actor and where I see myself and, you know, maybe that's something that you have seen from me in our limited interactions, then maybe that's something that I should, you know, harvest.
Yeah, I would say look at the great comedic performers that have parlayed their natural straight manness into humor. So I would say
the first person that comes to mind is Vince Vaughn, even though he's not the most iconic, but he's someone who started. Like he did The Cell, which is like a really, you know, serious movie, and now he's known as a comedy actor.
Yeah, he can do kind of both, because I think in one of my favorite performances of his is in Swingers. I love that movie.
Yes.
He's the sillier guy of him and Jon Favreau in that film. But there are definitely movies where Vince Vaughn is more the straight man and whatever. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, the people that I think have been the most successful at like parlaying straight man into humor, I would say somebody like Bob Newhart is like exceptional at it.
Yes.
And is underrated to a certain extent. And I would say, you know, I would say Bill Cosby to a certain extent, because there are moments, especially on The Cosby Show, there's this one moment that I love and I always come back to, like, on YouTube if I just need to laugh because it's just perfect. Is there's a clip from the Cosby Show where, like, he's just trying to find a place to sit down and, like, read his morning paper, right? So he goes into the living room, and his daughter and his daughter's boyfriend at the time, they're watching, like, reggae on, like, TV. And the amount of humor that is mined from him simply trying to read his paper peacefully in the room while they're watching, like, a music performance on TV is so funny. And his facial expressions are almost nothing. Almost nothing. But they're not nothing. There's something there. And it's perfection. And it's, I always come back to it because I just think it's such a perfect example of how funny a straight man can be. Because you watch that scene and yeah, like, the silly stuff that's going on is funny, but it's not nearly as funny as what he's doing by simply not moving his face almost at all. Like, it's incredible. So I just would say that, like, there are just so many ways that, and I really do think that people respond to the less you do as the more that you do, like, to a certain extent. Like, the less you are, A, trying to be funny, the more successful you will be as somebody who's funny. It's almost like there's that great Simpsons episode where they had, like, a barbershop quartet, like him and Barney and I think Mo and, like, Apu or whatever it was. They had, like, a barbershop quartet. It's like a backstory episode of, like, oh yeah, Homer used to have a barbershop quartet, and there's, like, a Skinner, Principal Skinner, is, like, in the band or whatever, and it was, like, it's this part of the episode that's kind of like mimicking, like, the Beatles thing of, like, there's the cute one and the funny one and this that and the other, and, like, there's a moment where, like, they're asking, like, Skinner what he is, and I think it's that he says, I can't remember if he says it or somebody says it, but he says that, like, he's the funny one. And, like, he just says it so straight that, like, everybody, like, all the press people just, like, laugh really hard or something. Like, I'm not doing the moment justice, but, like, I just love how humor can be mined from literally nothing. I think that's the most beautiful aspect of humor. That's it is its highest art, is, like, can you do almost nothing and make somebody laugh? I think the tone of your voice is so suited towards what I'm talking about. Like, it's even you just going, is funny in the right context. You know what I mean? Like, it's
right.
There's something there that you don't even have to do. That's just, I don't know. I think it's funny. And I would use you in those capacities were we to work together.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to look at that, because I haven't thought about that kind of thing.
I don't think there's anything funnier than somebody who's serious about what they're doing, whether they're being crazy or they're being serious. You know what I mean? Like,
that's true.
I think the best crazy entertainers are very serious as they're being crazy. Like, they're like, no, no, no. Like, I really think this, or whatever it may be.
That's why, like, to use, and I'm not even going to say his name because I don't know what the status of the YouTube thing is, but that's why AJ and DT are so funny.
I don't even know who that is. I don't know who you're...
Oh, okay. Well...
Oh, yeah. No, I got it.
Yeah.
I read between the lines here.
Yeah. That's why AJ is so funny.
Yeah.
Like, those clips that you see, because he's dead serious, and he's just got the spirit of God in him, you know? And it just... You can't help but laugh at it.
No. Well, for those who didn't pick up on it, we're talking about Alex Jones and Donald Trump.
Okay, fair enough. I don't know what the status of YouTube is now, and I want to preserve any reach that I can for this. So
I don't care. This
fair enough. Fair enough.
No, I 100%. Donald Trump, if you don't think he's funny, there's something wrong with you. You know, whatever you think of his politics, like, you cannot deny his performative chops, much like with Alex Jones. These people are popular, yes, because people agree with what they have to say. A lot of people, some people don't, whatever. But they're popular because there are 100 other people saying the exact same thing, and they're not popular.
Yes.
They're popular because there's something funny about what they do. And if it wasn't there, they wouldn't be the guy. It would be some other guy.
Yeah. I mean, Trump's probably one of the funniest, probably the funniest president that we've ever had.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a political, you know, historian by any chance. I'm sure somebody will write in the comments like, actually, Woodrow Wilson was fucking funny as shit. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, because I don't know what I don't know. But yes, in the modern of what I've experienced, and like, he puts, like, people thought of Bill Clinton as like the laid back, funny president. Like, fuck, that was a canard, because
yes,
Donald Trump is way more than that.
Yeah.
Way more in that direction.
Well, he's a type of funny that presidents, quote, aren't allowed to be.
Yes.
You know, and so he broke that mold. And so now it's, you know, it's the genie is out of the bottle.
Yes, I do believe the genie is out of the bottle. I think we're, whatever is next in 4 years from now, 8 years from now, it's going to be in direct response to what we've been allowed to a certain extent. I don't think we can go back to a more
tame.
Yeah. And also, like, Republicans to a certain extent. Like, when I was growing up, Republicans were like, you know, it was like PBS. It was like they would have like George Will on or something. And it was very just like, and he's just like, what the fuck? Is this like an actual person? Like, you just can't even, it just seems like a depiction. You know, it's just like, what even is that? Like, that's not a dude. Like, I don't know who that is. All right. So to wrap this up, because we've gone for a while, I guess. We always end this show. I don't know if you remember. I don't know how many episodes you've heard, but we end this show with stupid questions. Can I ask you some stupid questions?
Please.
All right. Right off the bat, your first name is Kurt, right?
Yes.
Do you find yourself to be Kurt, as in the adjective Kurt, like C-U-R-T?
100%.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I find myself to be, and it's something that I'm working on. I don't necessarily want it to be what I'm known for, but I definitely can be short and do not suffer fools.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, that's cool. Okay, next stupid question. Let's go to the next stupid question. Some of these I'm just going to be pulling out of thin air. You know, that was really the only research I did was I looked at your name and I was like, what can I do with that?
This is one of those hard-hitting interviews then.
Yeah, all right, next stupid question. What's it like to be on a cruise ship?
What's it like? It's like being a child and in the military. It's like being in the Congo of Africa. You're a child soldier. No, what I mean is that, like, some days you feel like they think that you're stupid, and then there's other days where they think that you're in the military and have to, you know, have everything buttoned up. And it honestly is what has made me more conservative politically, because you see firsthand the inefficiencies of large corporate structures. And you think, well, if it's this bad on one cruise ship for one corporation, how bad must the government be? And so that has created a lot of just skepticism of large organizations of me. And so, but working on a cruise ship, actually, to be honest, if you can ignore the bureaucracy and just stay out of the way and not ruffle any feathers and just do what you need to do, it's an amazing experience, because you get to travel the world. You room and board's paid for, food's paid for. For me, I was a performer, so I was getting paid well to do what I love and travel the world for free with my wife. I mean, it's kind of a dream scenario for a season.
Yeah, I've never been on one. I remember when we met up for lunch and, like, I walked you back to your ship. It was genuinely like, oh my God. It was just, first of all, it was so much bigger than I thought it was going to be. Like, just walking up to it, it literally looked like there was just a building in the water. Like, it was very, very surreal.
And that ship is small now.
Wow.
Comparison to what Royal Caribbean has been building. That is, like, I think in like 2016, that ship was the 14th largest ship in the sea. And it's probably like in the 20s now.
Wow.
Because they just keep building bigger and bigger ships.
It's funny, because the beginning of your answer, I thought you were going like really, really profound when you said, like, it's like being a child and also like being in the military. Like I thought you were going like, oh wow, like it's like being a kid on a cruise ship, but then it's also like there's a rigidness to it. And then you were like, oh no, it's being like a child soldier. And I was just like, oh man, that was just like that was such a lesser, like,
yes,
profound, no,
it's,
statement.
Yes, it's not you know, the first
version of that was so good. You had to just stick with the first version. That was so much better.
I will. That's probably a more PR savvy way to put it, because I'm releasing this film shot on a cruise ship without permission. So I probably should develop more of a PR line of thinking that's more favorable to the company that I defrauded to shoot this film on.
All right. Well, first of all, you didn't break any laws. There's no. I really do think that, like, people get more scared of doing things than they should be, to a certain extent.
But they could send me a cease and desist, like, you filmed on this property that's private property without a permission.
Well, let's play that scenario out, okay?
Okay.
Let's say, worst case scenario, they're like, hey, you weren't allowed to do this. What are you doing? There's plenty of precedent in this regard, when it comes to most recently. I think probably the most recent example would be a guy shot a movie at Disneyland that,
yes,
didn't have permission. And mm-hmm. the correct and proper response, and this was a commercially released film. This wasn't something going up on YouTube. This wasn't something where you can say, like, hey, this isn't commercial. Like, I just made something. I made a piece of art, but it's not getting sold to some distributor, and it's not being put in theater. Like, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Even in the instance of this guy shooting this very subversive, I would say shitty movie at Disneyland, because I don't think it was very good at all. He was kind of like, he was fine, you know, like it was okay. So I think, what you're doing is so not that, and is so not even in that territory. And so, like, mm-hmm. I would say, like, you're fine. And I'm not a lawyer, but, like, I really don't. And I look, also, I'll say that I've known people who you even know that have shot things places where they're not allowed to, and have suffered at most the consequence of, they got fired from the place, but, like,
yeah,
they, if you ask them, they would say, I would much rather have made the film than still work there. Like,
yeah,
because art is, what are we talking about here? It's like creation, right? You made something,
yeah,
you know?
Oh, 100%. I'm not worried about, I don't know. It's one of those, like, I'll cross that bridge when I get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I will consult a lawyer and show them the cut of the film and be like, throw the book at me. What can I expect? And then I will have multiple contingency plans for what to do given the different potential reactions. And I know that it's a piece of art and I want it to be true to my expression, but if there's a way, I don't know, I just kind of have to game theory it out. Like, it's not that I'm not willing to compromise what the vision is, if that means, if there's a world in which it can get a wider release than I was originally intended, but I have to maybe slice a few things to compromise in order to, like, guarantee no legal ramifications. I'm open to that. I'm practical in that regard. If the finish line, or if the outcome, is objectively better than it would have been had I left that little thing in. Because most of it, I would say just the act of creating it was pure enough to me. And then if I want to game out different tiers of scale of release, but that comes with compromises, we'll see what happens when we get there. I don't know.
Yeah. I would say, if you were Sony shooting a movie in secret on their ship, you would be in a lot of problems. But
sure.
You as,
but I'd also be curious what Sony would say if they were like, we want to buy it, but you have to do XYZ for us to buy it. I'm not saying that I would do what they say, but I'd be curious to hear what their concerns were. And then wonder, like, am I willing to meet them in a place to where that's a thing?
I would, you know, be, I guess, yeah, I would be curious to know it as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just for curiosity's sake, mostly.
Exactly. Exactly. Because the thing that frustrated me, I posted the video on Reddit, the YouTube video I made about making it. And it like got a lot of traction on Reddit. And in true Reddit form, majority of the comments were like, you'll never release this. Distributors won't ever touch this. And it was just a bunch of like loser mentality. And I was like, of course, that's the first thing y'all say is that I shouldn't have done this because I'm breaking a rule. Like, fuck y'all, you know?
Yes.
It's crazy.
Like, I have it's never, crazy. I found a couple wonderful people on Reddit, but I've never found great advice receiving like hundreds of thousands of upvotes or what. You know what I mean? Like, it just never happens. Like, the best... Because I really do think it's like almost a broken system to a certain extent. I've seen so many instances where the guy who actually has the proper answer, and I know that they have the proper answer because I know what the truth is, will have like two upvotes. And the person with the absolute wrong answer who is pandering to the type of person who would use Reddit and the nerds that care about whatever they care about has the most upvotes, even though it's completely wrong, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just a flawed system. There's positives, there's negatives, whatever. All right, so let me think of one last stupid question, and then we'll get out of here.
Okay, let me ask you a stupid question.
Oh, please do, please do.
If you were forced to eat meat,
okay,
and you had to sit down, what would be your meat of choice? Like, what would be like a dish that if someone's like, you got to do it today, what would you choose to eat?
Okay, that's a great question. My answer has changed over time. When I watched Jiro Dreams of Sushi, I don't know if you've seen that movie.
Oh, yes.
When I watched that movie, I was like, I would eat Jiro's sushi.
Oh, like, there you go.
It's like a fucking commercial. Like, even me, like a guy who's been vegan his whole life, by the end of that movie, I was like, I would eat that fucking fish.
Oh, yeah, dude. Absolutely.
So if you ask me right after I've watched Jiro Dreams of Sushi, I'd be like, I'm eating some fucking sushi.
Okay. Yeah.
In life, in just in general, I would probably stay away from the more greasier stuff like fried chicken or something like that, just because like I really do think a lot of what that is what you're doing to the meat. To a certain extent, you know, it's the spices, it's the deep fried or whatever it is, you know. I think it's getting a lot of zhuzhing.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to treat it very purely and be like, all right, I'm going to eat a piece of meat, I would be like, all right, give me the most classic and best steak that you can present to me.
Sure.
And I will meet that head on. Pun intended, you know.
For you, it might be like a filet mignon because it's a leaner cut of beef. There's not a lot of fat on it.
Yeah, and I might have one or two bites. You know, I don't know. But
the point is,
like, I'm going to take it seriously and be like, all right, yeah, I will have steak. You know, prepare it as best you think it should be prepared, and I'll have some bites of that. That would be my version of doing it because I really don't think it would be cheap if I was like, oh, I'll have chicken nuggets that are like mostly like breadcrumbs and like, you know, like it's just like and shitty meat. And you know what I mean? Like, it's just like,
yes,
whatever. Like, it tastes the exact same as like the fake ones because the real ones are mostly fake anyway. You know what I mean? Like, it's there's so many versions of that. Like, there's cheese that's like, you know, 1% different than the 100% imitation cheese. Like, there's cheese you buy that's like, they put enough actual cheese in it just to qualify it as cheese. you know, it's very strange.
It's why I don't eat a lot of cheese.
Yeah.
Because of that.
It's like if I was going to have cheese, I'd be like, just give me some like genuinely, a genuinely good piece of cheese. Don't give me like, you know, some slice of cheese that's like mostly filler or whatever.
Fair enough. Cool.
Yeah, I'm by slice of cheese, I mean like, you know, pre-packaged slices of cheese. You know, I would go to an actual cheese store and like have actual cheese. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Good question, though. I will ask you a similar question, and then we'll go. Were you to have something vegan, what's something vegan that you actually enjoy? Like what's something non-meat, non-cheese, non-egg that you love as food?
I make often for lunch a vegan dish. The longevity guy, Brian Johnson, has a whole recipe book, and I've made a handful of his recipes, and I really enjoy him. There's this one dish that he eats all the time that I eat frequently called Super Veggie. And it's just a ton of broccoli, cauliflower, shiitake mushrooms, black lentils with garlic, ginger, hemp seed, olive oil, cumin, and dark chocolate. And it's like, you know, it tastes like a bunch of broccoli, but it's good. But in terms of stuff that I think is like yummy, man, like, honestly, tomatoes, olive oil, and balsamic vinegar with some basil. You know, it's a really caprese salad without the mozzarella.
Yeah, I just love,
even though tomatoes are nightshades and you're supposed to eat those because they're inflammatory, they're just so good, man. And I'm trying to, I don't know. It's hard for me. If you hadn't asked me the question I just told you in conversation, I'd probably have a more accurate database, but I can't think of anything now. But I do. I love vegetables, man. I love vegetables. I'm vegan curious for sure. I don't think I could go full vegan ever, but I definitely understand what they got. Why? I understand why people are vegan.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
you know,
I really do think, as most people have noted, your palate does change when you become vegan. Like it, I've talked to so many people that like they just never really tasted vegetables until it was what they were primarily eating.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. It just changes you. All right. Well, Kurt Jenkins, thank you for coming on Vegan Living today. But for real, I wish you so much luck with the film. I can't wait to see it. I hope that motivates you to finish it even more than you've already you know, wanted to finish it. I hope, because I really do think not just me, but a lot of people want to see what that film is like.
Yeah, man. And I got to give a shout out to you, for being so open to, you know, to us communicating online and for you being open to kind of being a mentor to hold my hand through this first cycle of making something. Cause I think, you know, I've been talking about making something for so long and everyone was getting sick of hearing it and I was getting sick of feeling like a poser. And it's just, thank you for holding my hand to get me, you know, started on the momentum of it. So, but yeah, thank you for helping me.
Yeah, man. First of many films for you, I'm sure. I would always say that once you feel like you're able to make one a year, then you're in a good place. Like once you get to that point, you know, you might be working on this film for the rest of this year and that's fine. But like at a certain point as a filmmaker, when you're cooking, you feel like you could do one a year for sure.
Yeah. I think I would love to have this film out by summer just to get it out of my body. And then spend the rest of the year writing my next one.
Sounds good. All right, Kurt. Great to talk to you, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Thank you all for listening, and once again, killlinefilms.com. We're only asking a dollar. You know, just start donating a dollar per month to us. Keeps the podcast afloat, keeps everything that we do here as far as making movies afloat. Very simple ask, and hopefully you do it, and if you have done it, great. $1 per month. Thank you for listening. See you soon.